Welcome back to Monty and Rias versus Movies.
Versus Movies.
I am Monty.
I'm Rias.
This week, the only wide release movie appeared to be Shazam: Fury of the Gods.
And although I found the first Shazam movie charming,
yeah, it was fun.
It didn't actually leave an empty part in my soul that can only be filled by a second Shazam movie.
Yeah. And, you know, we had that Black Adam movie, which was kind of a second Shazam movie, although, yeah. So we did not watch Shazam: Fury of the Gods.
No, we did not.
Instead, we went to a tiny, tiny theater in Seattle that shows, like, art house stuff. And explain The Grand Illusion, Rias.
The Grand Illusion is the country's oldest continuous working, I think it's a not-for-profit repertory theater.
Okay.
It is a little tiny, tiny place. The theater's probably, there are people who have living rooms smaller than this theater. Not us. We live in an apartment.
It's pretty close to the size of this living room, actually, looking around it.
Yeah, yeah. It's, what we're saying is it's a little theater. It does not have a giant and mighty theater screen.
Yep. This is the theater where I first saw Eraserhead.
That's perfectly on course, yes.
I saw It's a Wonderful Life there for the first time.
Thus, they show it every Christmas and have been for like 30 years.
Yeah. And this time...
And they always have a free screening, which is nice.
Yeah. And this time, we saw a movie called Hamburger Dad.
It's about a dad... Hang on. Who is a hamburger?
This is a 20th anniversary screening, because apparently they screened it once when it was first came out 20 years ago. And, okay. I feel like Rias is going to have to explain where Hamburger Dad came from.
If you remember our previous podcast, Rias and Monty versus Movies Post-Apocalypse.
Yes.
You may remember a little film that we talked about that we still love.
Steel of Fire Warriors.
Steel of Fire Warriors. So the people, the guy, one of the guys who stars in Steel of Fire Warriors, Kevin Clark, years ago, since high school, has been making films with his best friend, Will Long. They used to do a lot of goofy short, you know, the kind of films you make when you're in high school.
Yes.
And I believe Hamburger Dad was their first feature length, it's an hour long,
yes,
film. And the plot is, a man wakes up one morning, looks in the mirror, realizes he has turned into a hamburger.
This is reinforced through the dialogue. For instance, a lot of times, Rias, you be Jeff, the son, because Hamburger Dad does have a son, and you say, Dad, why are you in such a bad mood?
Dad, why are you in such a bad mood?
Well, I lost my job, your mother left me, and I'm a hamburger.
Ooh, that's good. That was very close to Kevin's actual delivery.
He mentions he's a hamburger a lot.
In every scene, and it is always funny and always a delight.
The hamburger in question is a hamburger, nothing on it. It's like an inch thick blackened patty.
On a bun. That's all you get. So that's the hamburger. And over the movie, Hamburger Dad and his son go on a road trip together and end up being friends.
Yes. The son is trying to hook up with some girl.
We're not going to spoil the ending because it is amazing.
We're not going to spoil Hamburger Dad.
No. No, we would never.
The first thing that happens is that he wakes up and says, I'm a hamburger.
Right. And then his wife leaves him because she doesn't want to be married to a hamburger.
And because he lost his job because he's a hamburger.
Yeah. His output at work has dropped to zero on account of not having any hands.
It's not clear what he can do. He can clearly move around.
Not on camera, he can't.
But at the beginning in the POV shot, it does move.
The camera does move, so in the POV shot, but none of this needs to be explained.
Right. Most of the movie is just, there is a hamburger on the table and it's talking to Jeff, or...
Right, and this is accomplished by the expedient manner of having Kevin Clark yelling his lines from offstage.
Yes, there was a director Q&A after the screening of Hamburger Dad, so you know it's a classy movie.
Exactly.
And we learned that the way the audio was done for the movie is they had a microphone that you would have on a computer that runs Windows 95, and it was just sitting on the floor.
Yeah, and they would try to kind of talk louder near the microphone.
It's a fun movie. It's incredibly amateurish, and I think it's more amateurish than they actually were.
Yeah, it was shot on video.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's on a VHS tape where it is available to rent from Scarecrow Video.
Ooh.
And possibly purchase from Strange Tapes VHS Oddities Unearthed.
Yes, the reason this movie got a 20th anniversary screening is that the guy who does this zine, Strange Tapes VHS Oddities Unearthed, was in Seattle. He went to Scarecrow Video because of course he did.
Well, he's only human.
And he went to the local filmmakers section, which has good movies by people like Lynn Shelton, and he picked out Hamburger Dad.
Well, you know, that it is in a cassette tape. It's in a VHS box, which has writing on it that looks like it was done by a child.
Yeah.
In crayon. So it's hard not to notice it. And if you're a person that seeks out VHS oddities, it is absolutely the movie you should rent.
Yeah. This screening was a lot of fun.
It was.
It sold out, which is great news. It means there was like 30 people there.
Yeah. Many of the audience members were in the film 20 years ago and are still friends with Kevin and showed up for it.
I mean, the crowd was largely Scarecrow Video and Grand Illusion people and hanger-on movie nerds like me. Like, it was all people I like immediately.
Yeah, it was all people who should be seeing a screening of a movie called Hamburger Dad.
Yeah.
There was no guy who had wandered in off the street thinking he was going to see high art.
Oh, that is a shame, though.
And I really liked Hamburger Dad. There's a movie called Black Devil Doll from Hell, which gets a lot of press because of, for being what it is, which is a homemade...
Vile. It is vile.
It is a vile homemade VHS movie that was remade, but we're all talking about the original VHS tape. And Hamburger Dad is so much better and deserves so much more attention.
Yeah. I was really happy for Kevin and Will that they got to be there for a sold-out screening of their ridiculous movie.
A sold-out screening full of people who love their ridiculous movie.
Yeah.
That is awesome, and I'm probably speaking from a place of full disclosure. They're my friends.
Yeah.
But
Rias
still,
is one of the Scarecrow people.
But still, it was awesome. I'm so happy for them. And I hope that this movie becomes available so that more people can see it, because it's a weird one.
It is a weird one. That's a true statement.
Absolutely. But it is honestly funny.
I mean, I gasped when something happened to the hamburger at one point, so that's something.
That's true. That's true.
Like, I was emotionally invested in this hamburger.
Yeah, it's true. He does a lot of things. He goes to a party. He falls in a toilet.
Mm-hmm.
Someone takes a bite of him at some point.
Yeah.
It's
for some reason, Jeff goes to McDonald's with his dad and goes to the bathroom, and somebody comes by and busses the table and throws his father away. Oh, no.
Yeah. And in all of these, you feel that sense of urgency, like, oh, no, don't throw his dad. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Now what happens?
Kevin said that they were not inspired by Kafka's Metamorphosis, but they were inspired by the title of the movie Ghost Dad.
Yes.
That's him guessing, because they don't remember anything. This was 20 years ago.
They were in one of those all-night diner situations, you know, like you do when you're in your 20s and you're at a Denny's with everybody.
Yeah.
And you're randomly talking crap about movies, and it comes to the conversation of, well, if a ghost can be a dad, what other things can a dad be? And then somebody said, hamburger. What if it was a hamburger dad? And that's how they came up with it, which is the best way to come up with movies.
And they actually made the movie, and that's an accomplishment.
Yeah. And they did road trips. They filmed on location.
Yeah.
They rented not one, but two different hotel rooms.
They have a shot outside the Metro, the theater in Seattle. It's right by Stella's, which isn't there anymore, but was a 24-hour Italian joint that I loved so much.
I know. I was so nostalgic when they showed the Metro theaters. I was like, oh, man, you're killing me with this.
Now it's an AMC. It was a Sundance theater, briefly.
Also, it was fun for me to see my friends 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, look, they survived to adulthood. I never would have guessed from this movie.
And I'm guessing that was constant for you throughout the movie. Like, I know Kevin shows up and go, oh, it's Kevin. But I'm guessing people at that party, you're like, oh, there's that person.
Yeah, there was Tommy was there, and he was like 18. I'm like, that's baby Tommy.
Is Tommy in Seattle now?
Yeah, he runs a theater called the Beacon Theater, which is kind of like the Grand Illusion. It's a little art house theater. They have amazing stuff going there. It's up on, I'm not sure where it is because I haven't been there, but I look at their website a lot and I'm like, I should go see that.
This is Tommy, tell me if I'm wrong about this, Tommy Swenson, who yes. worked at Scarecrow, then went off to Austin to be a bigwig at Draft House and then came back?
I don't know if he was a bigwig. I know he edited a lot of their... He edited the trailers that they show before movies and put together stuff like that. I'm going to call him a bigwig.
Like, not a corporate bigwig, but he was programming and stuff.
A lot of people from Scarecrow end up working at the Alamo Drafthouse. And I guess it's kind of a thing that happens when you're into cult films the way that we are.
Yeah.
It's like... Someone came in to apply for a job at Scarecrow one time, and it was some guy that was just looking for a job in general and put in an application. And after he left, one of my coworkers looked at me and said, "He doesn't get it. He doesn't know it's a calling." And honestly, that's how I felt the whole time working there, because you certainly aren't working there for high wages or any benefits. It is a...
Or being treated nice by the customers.
Or being treated nice by the customers. People who work at Scarecrow and probably any other surviving video stores are there specifically because they love film.
Yeah.
So be nice to them.
Yeah. And that's why we saw Hamburger Dad and enjoyed it.
Yes. But we've also seen other movies, movies that a normal person might see.
Yes. Now, Rias is kind of in a Chinese mode right now. So she led the next two movies we're going to talk about.
Yep. It turns out that I, a person who loves their martial arts movies, had never seen Once Upon a Time in China.
Now, a movie that starts Once Upon a Time in, that should be significant. There's Once Upon a Time in America. Henry Fonda goes west, and over like 12 hours, he tames the West single-handedly.
There's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in which Quentin Tarantino masturbates to the ghost of Sharon Tate.
Now, did I say that was Once Upon a Time in the West or Once Upon a Time in America?
You said Once Upon a Time in America.
Yeah, Once Upon a Time in America is actually the mob movie, I think.
I think it's about Irish immigrants.
Okay.
Anyway, there's a lot of movies that start Once Upon a Time in, but I believe that those are all riding the coattails of Once Upon a Time in China.
Tell us about Once Upon a Time in China, Rias.
Well, there's this guy that I've heard of in some other movies named Wong Fei-hung.
Wong Fei-hung? That's who Jackie Chan plays in Legend of Drunken Master, or Drunken Master 2. Yes, also in Drunken Master 1, I guess.
Yes, Wong Fei-hung was a real guy. I don't know that much about him, but what I do know about him is that he's kind of, although he's based on a real guy, he's kind of a legendary character.
Yeah, he's been played by everybody?
Yeah, he's like, it's like Robin Hood. Wong Fei-hung is like Robin Hood.
Yeah, he appears to fight against the brutal foreign oppression a lot.
I believe the first movie about Wong Fei-hung was made in the 1920s. It's a silent film.
Nice.
He has been around and doing kung fu for a very long time. In real life, he was a doctor, and I'm not, like I said, I don't know much about the real life character, but I know that he is in a ton of movies. If you're watching a martial arts films from a certain era, 80s or 90s Hong Kong movies, they loved him.
Yeah.
He was all over the place. He was Wong Fei-hunging it up. My favorite Wong Fei-hung movie is Iron Monkey.
That's a good one.
Which I really like. But I've also got one, a movie called The Legend of...
Fong Sai-yuk.
The Legend of Fong Sai-yuk, where I believe Fong Sai-yuk is Wong Fei-hung.
I find that confusing, and I'm not sure I believe it.
Well, it's possible because the only time I've seen the movie was a real old VHS tape. So it is entirely possible that they subtitled it to say he was Fong Sai-yuk just to make the movie more acceptable to people who were into martial arts films at the time.
Fong Sai-yuk does have his own Wikipedia page. Anyway, what if we talked about a movie we actually watched, Once Upon a Time in China?
Oh, Once Upon a Time in China is a good time. White people are the villains.
Makes sense.
Who
plays Wong Fei-hung in this movie?
It's Jet Li.
Jet Li, he rules.
I just saw a recent interview with him I was watching on YouTube, and he was talking about making this movie, and they showed a scene from it, and I was like, I don't remember that. Surely I have seen Once Upon a Time in China. It is a foundational film of the genre. But no, I hadn't.
Shameful.
So I watched it. I very much enjoyed it. I feel like the interesting thing for me about it is there's a character named Foon, who starts off as kind of a comedy relief character. He's the dumb guy.
Yeah. Jet Li doesn't play dumb guys. Jet Li plays, as far as I can tell, immaculate, incredible fighters, period.
Yeah.
And Foon starts
and good
off.
For him.
Foon wants to be Wong Fei Hung's disciple, but he's too goofy, so he doesn't get
right.
to.
Right. He's trying to be an actor, but he falls off the roof of the theater and pours a bucket of poop on the main actress. You know, the kind of hijinks that comedy relief get up to in martial arts films.
Foon is played by Yuan Biao. I apologize for that pronunciation. He was one of the seven little fortunes at the Peking Opera School. He was the third most famous. The most famous are Jackie Chan and Sammo Hung. And those two and Yuan were in a bunch of movies together before they... Rise just shook her head.
Maybe not.
I'm saying they did movies together before some of them started breaking out.
Okay. I don't know. I'd have to look that up, but I'm going to trust you on it.
All right. That was, let's say, vaguely researched. The point is, Yuan Biao has kind of a Jackie Chan quality to him. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he has some scenes where he runs away from the villains, much in the way that Jackie Chan does in some of his movies.
Yeah.
Now, what I like about this movie, though, is that even though he's a secondary character, we follow him from being a complete loser as he climbs the ranks to finally be accepted as Wong Fei Hung's student. And it's kind of a nice story to see the secondary character being featured.
Yeah.
Because Jet Li's character starts out at the top and continues to stay at the top. You know, whenever there's a big fight going on in a bar and he walks in, the fight breaks up and everybody scatters. He's that kind of guy.
But Foon has character development. I like Foon a lot. And it's really a movie about Foon, except that Jet Li is in it. So Jet Li is going to be doing some amazing stuff. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. And, you know, I really like the kind of martial arts movie where you can tell a fight is about to happen and you look at the screen and you see a bunch of ladders and a warehouse and some scaffolding, because you know all of that's going to get used.
Yeah, there's this great scene where the bad guy is showing off for his minions and he's just jumping around and kicking stuff, and he kicks this big metal hook and it spins around and smashes this, and now there's this dangerous thing floating in the scene. You're like, oh, in about 20 minutes that thing is going to get some action.
Yep. Because you've now been introduced, because that scene introduces you to the set where the main fight is going to take place, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah, I really liked Once Upon a Time in China. We also rented Once Upon a Time in China 2. We're going to watch that, although I might push for watching Drunken Master 2 first.
Do you own Drunken Master 2? Because I did not rent it.
I do own Drunken Master 2.
Aw. Okay, I guess we'll watch Drunken Master 2.
Oh, we just might watch Jackie Chan's most fun movie. Oh, no.
No, don't make me watch that.
It's just about this same historical period, which we're trying to figure out. Speaking of historical periods we're trying to figure out.
Oh, yeah. We watched Ang Lee's Lust Caution.
Yes. I had never seen it.
Neither had I.
I felt like I had never heard of it, but it's been covered on the Blank Check podcast, so I definitely have heard of it.
I watched it because it is set during the same era and involves some of the same actors and spy groups as that Hidden Blade movie, which I'm still not able to completely figure out. So I was like, oh, maybe this will be a little guide. I did not expect quite so much of Tony Leung being naked and having sex.
Yeah, this turns out to be an erotic thriller.
There's only three sex scenes, but they do not...
They are sex scenes.
Yeah.
In my opinion, he treats that young lady fairly disrespectfully.
Definitely in the first sex scene, but then she becomes, as her character develops, she gets stronger and then she's in charge during the sex. But yeah, it's a little problematic. But
yeah, I wasn't saying it was problematic.
Look, she's a spy and the point is that she is doing what she has to do to get Tony Leung's character assassinated.
Yeah, and
he is he's working with the Japanese.
And this is a movie that is very clear about everybody's motivations. Says up front, Japanese occupied Shanghai. These are the collaborators. These are the people who want to kill the collaborators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very easy to follow. Really good clothes.
Oh my God, the clothes in the movie.
And it seemed like every review I read, they're just talking about the sex scenes in it because they're really graphic.
But there's a half
but
the movie.
Those do not take most of the movie. Those happen later in the movie. It's like a 2.5 hour movie, and I'd say like 15 minutes maybe is sex scenes.
There is way more Mahjong than sex in this movie.
Ah, I got to learn how to play Mahjong.
Propaganda works.
It is. It's got Joan Chen playing Mahjong, and I have loved her since Blood of Heroes and Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
So it's fun to see her in fancy clothes just being great.
Yeah.
Even though it's a minor part, she said she would be happy to take any role as long as she got to work with Ong Lee.
Yeah.
And she read the story and said, this is a minor role, but I'm excited by it. I'm taking it.
This is the movie he made immediately after Brokeback Mountain won him an Oscar.
Yeah.
An interesting choice.
Yeah, because there's no graphic sex scenes in Brokeback Mountain at all. There's not even a sex scene, really. Oh, you do get to see a guy run naked and jump into a
stream.
There's
a sex scene.
It's very...
He lubes his fingers up and goes after him. There is okay. A sex scene.
That's not what I remember about that movie.
Well, that's the thing. It's not as graphic.
I remember Brokeback Mountain as a sad love story.
Yeah, exactly. The sex scenes are not as graphically explicit as in Love Caution. I'm going to say
sex
this.
Sex Caution.
I'm going to say this.
Lust
about,
Caution.
I'm going to say this about Lust Caution. I believe there was penetration in that movie.
I think there was, too.
That's just based on my own eyes, but...
Tony Leung says eyes. I was acting, but you can act while you're having sex.
you sure can.
The young lady in the movie did not say it was not sex.
Yeah.
But Tony Leung is married and she isn't, so...
Yeah.
It's just a rough day on the set for Tony.
Well, I thought Lust Caution was a startling movie.
I know, because it goes on so long and you're with no lust. It's just caution. And then all of a sudden, there's lust and there's so much of it.
Yeah.
I loved that about it.
Yeah. That's all the movies we've seen.
I think so. We've been watching some TV.
Yeah, we watched all of Next in Fashion.
That is a Netflix show that is kind of a ripoff of Project Runway in a way.
Yeah. The hosts are Tan France from the new Queer Eye. I forget who the host was the first season.
I don't remember either.
The other host this season is Gigi Hadid.
And she's actually kind of delightful.
She's great. I really liked her in this.
Yeah, she was really good. She was fun.
She's charming with the designers. She's good at the terrible skits they do in
the
reality shows?
Banter, the fake banter. She's very good at delivering fake banter.
She hits the tone of those little skits perfectly.
Yeah.
She shows up wearing bizarre clothes that she wore to the Met Gala, which is amazing.
And also clothes that other people have worn to the Met Gala.
And she can say useful things, like there's a scene where somebody's being put in a giant hat and they won't be able to see. And Tan says, well, you won't be able to see. And the designer says, well, she'll just look down the whole time. And Gigi immediately says, oh, yeah, I've had to do that.
Yeah. Sometimes you can't see where you're going. You just look at your feet and hope for the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, and unlike like a lot of the designer challenging shows, this one seemed to have a real more of a focus on weird avant-garde styles, which is the stuff I like. I like the crazy, over-the-top, no one would wear this in the street kind of stuff. That's why I love the Met Gala more than I like the Oscars or whatever.
Yeah. Some people, the first few people went home, I think, were the people who made clothes that you would wear. They looked and said, oh, you could just buy this. We're not interested in clothes you can buy. We want people designing crazy things.
Yeah. And they got some really great crazy things.
Yeah.
And they had some really fun challenges.
And there's a tone that I think comes from Tan, because he's from Queer Eye, of really supporting the designers and not tearing them down, you know?
He seems really nice. There was a scene where Gigi Hadid is like, oh my God, my pants just ripped. And before she finishes saying it, before it's out of her mouth, Tan is like, I'll sew those up for you right over here. Because they're in a room full of sewing machines, and I'm sure they have production assistants or people on set who can sew, even the designers. But I thought it was really, it seemed really genuine.
Yeah, and they have guest judges, like this one personal stylist who I really liked.
Yeah, there was a guy who's a stylist who was great. They had
Oh yeah, they had Donatella Versace.
Donatella Versace on there.
They had Bella Hadid, which, you know, it's
that
not as
seems easy. That's just the host's sister.
But then you got to see Gigi and Bella hanging out as sisters, and that was charming.
Yeah, it was a fun little show, and I'm going to say not all of the clothes on it were to my taste.
That's true.
There is a guy who makes patchwork quilts out of denim and then makes those into clothes.
And, like, this is a guy with a very singular point of view. I don't think he would...
This is all he does.
I don't think he would work on Project Runway, but...
On this, he did well.
Yeah. Yeah, I really liked Next in Fashion. I found it charming. I want more of that right now.
Well, you're going to have to wait. The season just dropped. What else did we watch? There was something else we talked about.
I mean, that's pretty much all. Mm. I've been...
What are you looking forward to next couple weeks?
Well, John Wick 4 is going to hit theaters. I don't know if the TikTok man will be in it, but...
I don't believe he is.
Oh, that's a shame. The Dungeons & Dragons movie, Honor Among Thieves, is coming. And people, you're not going to believe this, people say it's good.
People I know... Well, see, we know a lot of people who work in the game industry who have very close ties to Dungeons and Dragons.
They work at Wizards of the Coast.
Yes. So they've seen it and they're like, it's really good. Now, one of those guys is my friend Jefferson, and he's not to be trusted.
Be nice.
No, I love him to death. He's one of my favorite people in the world, but he's very enthusiastic about film. I love that about him, but it doesn't make him the best judge of quality.
Yeah. Like, see, normally if somebody from Wizards of the Coast says, I just saw the D&D movie, it's great, I would be skeptical. But here's a story about the time the first D&D movie came out in 2000.
Oh, yes. Let's hear that D&D movie story. It's about Jeremy Irons is in that, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
When this movie was coming out, somebody, I will not say his name, although I do remember it, sent an email to the entire company saying, we have to support this movie, however it is. D&D movie being good is good for Dungeons & Dragons. Everybody must support this movie 100% in public at all times. Then we got a screening of it. A private theater. Just my coworkers. This is great.
Then you saw the movie.
Other movies that I saw for free while working at Wizards of the Coast were the Pokemon movie, all the Transformers movies, the Star Wars prequels.
Yes.
And Sorcerer's Apprentice, that Nick Cage movie, because there was a Magic the Gathering tie in it. You know what those movies have in common? They're pretty much all bad. The Dungeons and Dragons movie, we're all sitting in the theater. We're watching it. It's unfolding. And people are like, there's some shifting in the audience. Like, why is the dwarf as tall as the human? That's weird. And I think it was when the Beholder showed up and was A, very bad CGI, and B, distracted by a rock. That people started openly mocking the movie from the audience.
Oh, dear.
And that continued. And when we got out, there was no more word about we have to support Dungeons & Dragons. It was just pretend it didn't exist.
Well, what I understand about that movie was that someone had bought the rights to make a Dungeons & Dragons movie, and those rights were going to expire if they didn't make the movie within 6 months, and so they threw that together.
Yeah, it was one of those deals where TSR, who used to make Dungeons & Dragons, had no money, and they were like, sell off anything we can. This guy wants to make a movie? Sure. $1,000. Here's the rights.
Yeah. We didn't think, they didn't realize that $1,000 would be the budget of the film.
Yeah. And then he made that movie, and then he made another sequel to keep the rights, then he made a third sequel.
Yeah.
But the third sequel came out on TNT or TBS, and that was the excuse that Wizards of the Coast used to get the rights back. And now it's a real movie, and...
Yeah. And I hear it's good.
I'm just saying, nobody said that the last movie was good. People are saying this movie is good.
I like Chris Pine. He's generally good in things.
I got nothing against Chris Pine. He's pretty bland and generic for me.
Well, you know.
Like, what... What have I seen him in? I guess I've seen him as Captain Kirk.
You saw him in Wonder Woman.
Oh, yeah.
As Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
Whatever. I think he's nice. He seems nice. I'm saying that because I know someone who knows his father, and his father's nice. So there you have it.
I mean, he looks like he gets to have fun. He gets to be a goofy bard in this one, which is way more fun than
being
I was going to say more fun than being Captain Kirk. I think it is more fun than being Captain Kirk. I realize that is a minority opinion. That's why you have more people trying to be Captain Kirk and not enough people trying to be wacky bards.
Okay, bye.
Bye.